you to join them in supporting public broadcasting.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin our what would normally be our second hour of the show today. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about pensions and the future of pensions here in the United States. One of the things that we know is that today, maybe a quarter, roughly speaking, of American workers have a traditional defined benefit pension when they retire. And something else that we also know is that we're expecting that in the years to come, the number of workers covered by defined benefit plans will shrink. And they have been shrinking over a number of years now. There also seems to be some concern abroad that when people retire, there may or may not be the money there to pay them. Certainly, both corporate pension funds and public sector funds are significantly underfunded. So the question is, what exactly is the future here for our pensions? What direction are we going, and how might we address some of these concerns with policy? And so, as our guest in this part of Focus 580, we have Stephen Darcy. He is the John C. Brogan Faculty Scholar in Risk Management and Insurance. He is also Professor of Finance in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois. It's been good enough to come and spend a little time with us and talk. And of course, as we talk, as always, questions are welcome from people who are listening. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so we could keep the program moving along, get in as many different people as possible, but certainly questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line, so we'll save you the money on the call if it would be a long-distance call for you. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL or 9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Just to start, we were talking about this a little bit before we got going here. Maybe the absolute numbers aren't quite so critical as just acknowledging the trend that I mentioned. That is that over time now, over the past couple of decades, the numbers of people who are in these kind of traditional defined benefit pension plans, those numbers have been going down, fewer and fewer as time goes along. And apparently we have every reason to expect that trend will continue into the future and that we will have, again, even fewer people in these kind of traditional plans.
Yes, that's likely to be the trend. Let me start by explaining that there are two basic types of pension plans. One's a defined benefit plan, which you're referring to as the traditional plan. That pays a benefit to workers that's dependent upon their salary and the number of years they worked and some formulas like that. They define the benefit, and the employer takes the risk of funding that in case the investment performance isn't accurate. The alternative is a defined contribution pension plan. Defined contribution, a company just guarantees how much money they're going to put into it. That's always fully funded. Money goes into it. It's invested. You're not sure what you're going to be getting as a benefit. In general, you would be getting about the same level, but the risk bears with the employee because if the investment funds lose money, the employee is not guaranteed that a particular benefit. They're guaranteed what they grow to. Defined benefit pension plans, the traditional ones, are better for workers who are older and workers who are in a job for a very long period of time. For younger workers and more mobile workers, the defined contribution pension plans are better because the money continues to grow after you've left your job. So companies, in shifting from a defined benefit to defined contribution, are in some ways trying to attract a different type of labor force, younger workers, and realize that people are more mobile. In addition, the tremendous investment performance that occurred in the stock market from 1982 through 2000 made a lot of people that were in the defined benefit plans jealous because the other workers were making money, much more money, by being able to get 10, 15, 20% returns by investing in the stock market, and they felt that they were not getting as good a benefit. So in many cases, workers pressured companies to shift over to the defined contribution plans, and in some cases, those will be better. But it doesn't provide the guarantees, it doesn't provide the securities the traditional plans do.
Yeah. This other kind of plan, the defined contribution, there, I guess I think of the 401k with corporate with the corporate, with the employer match. Now, is that what we're talking about, or is or are there other kind of plans that don't involve the workers paying in, that it's still just the employer that pays in, but there's this question about what exactly the person is going to get?
Yeah. 401k is an example of a defined contribution plan, but there are other defined contribution plans that the employer pays everything. They will simply put in 5 or 10% of your salary, and that will grow to whatever it does by the time you leave the company. And then you can, it's portable, you can transfer it to a new plan that you get in another company or continue to let it grow.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the fact that there might have been a time when the stock market was particularly doing well, that people who had their retirement funds in some kind of investment that was sensitive to that, like a 401k, that the people in the defined benefit plans might have been looking at those folks and saying, gee, you know, they're making a lot of money and ours is just kind of stagnant. It's secure, it's there, but it's just sort of stagnant. But, you know, things turn around, and now that after we went through a period where the stock market was not performing quite as well and where there's some sort of uncertainty, then now maybe people with it, who are in defined contribution plans, now they're looking at the people who are in defined benefit plans and saying, well, gee, you know, we wish that we had it, we're in a plan like that because it's secure, unless, of course, the company, you know, files for Chapter 11, that's another issue. But it seems that it kind of depends on how things are going, which of those plans you think is going to be the best. I think, though, still overall, we have this idea that somehow defined benefit is better than defined contribution.
If you're going to be in a job for a long period of time, then a defined benefit plan is probably better for you than a defined contribution plan. If you're going to start working, as many young people do, in one job and then shift off 2 or 3 years later to another job and then every 5 or 6 years shift to a different job, then defined benefits really wouldn't be very good for you. You'd never accumulate enough of a benefit at any one company to make it worthwhile. You'd be better off with a defined contribution. Mm-hmm. So it is a little bit uncertainty knowing what your career path is going to be like and how the stock market is going to perform to know which one's the best one to do that.
Well, it seems though, as far as employers are concerned, they want to move away from defined benefit because it's at least you know, sort of the impression that I get from having read about it, they want to move away from defined benefit because they think it's costing them too much money.
Yes, the defined benefit plans do have an insurance plan behind them, which is good for the workers, but employers have to fund that guarantee fund, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. And as you're probably aware from reading recently, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is underfunded by at least $23 billion. And even this year, when United Airlines went into bankruptcy terminated its pension fund, it terminated another $6.6 billion in assets or in unfunded liabilities to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. And that has to be paid for by someone. The way the system is set up currently, if you have a defined benefit pension plan, you pay contributions to this fund, and as it becomes unfunded further, you have to pay higher contributions in the future. So some companies that have fully funded plans now are seeing the handwriting on the wall. They see that if they continue in this, the cost of the insurance that they're paying, which they won't benefit from because they're fully funded or as fully funded as they can be, is going to cover the companies that are underfunded and going out of business. And that cost increases, and it in some ways forces companies to go away from the defined benefit plan as a cost saving. And Sarbanes-Oxley, the Enron scandal that led to Sarbanes-Oxley, made companies more aware of risks that companies are taking. And boards of directors are very risk-averse at this time, and they're looking at what financial risks the corporations are facing. One risk they have is the investment risk associated with defined benefit pension plans, and that's pushing, again, companies that are willing to fund their plan fully, but realizing that if the stock market were to go down 2 years in a row at the 20% level that it did in 2000 to 2002, then they would have a tremendous liability for the company, and it's less risky for them simply to shift off to a different plan. And again, some workers prefer the other plan, although other workers, the long-time workers certainly are disadvantaged by shifting to a defined contribution plan.
As you mentioned, maybe we want to make sure that people understand that if a company goes under, can't meet its pension obligations, then the government steps in, and there is this entity called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. It's been around since, I guess, the mid-70s.
Yes.
And the idea is that, as you explained, that corporations pay, it is in fact a kind of an insurance agency for them and for the workers. The employers, the corporations pay a premium to this, and that is supposed to fund it so that then if a corporation goes under, then it can pay the pensions of the workers that the corporation can't meet anymore. And that there also is this concern that it, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, is underfunded, that it doesn't have enough money or the amount of money that people think it should have to meet potential demands from workers when corporations go under. Backing up just a step, one might ask the question, part of the problem here may indeed be that we have corporations that are not fully funding their pensions. And the question might be, why don't we, that is to say, why does not the government of the United States require all corporations to fully fund their pension programs?
When ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, was enacted in the mid-1970s, it had the dual purpose of trying to encourage companies to fully fund their plans and had some tremendous guidelines for what funds needed to do to fully fund their plans, and it introduced the insurance plan at the same time. Now, at that point, companies were supposed to fund their liabilities over a period of time so that they would be, by now, all fully funded, although whenever they gave a new enhancement, that would pass up. Unfortunately, the insurance inducement was so attractive for some companies that they minimally funded their plan. They put the minimum amount they could put in each year because they realized they were getting free insurance from the government or very low-cost insurance for the government. Their workers were protected, and it didn't cost them currently. Then companies started getting a financial difficulty. Legislators, unfortunately, have responded by allowing industries that are having difficulties to remain underfunded rather than get exemptions from fully funding on this one. Mm-hmm. And part of it's because they want to keep the companies going, so they're trying to make it easier for them to fund it, but it just pushes off the problem to the future. So if we did pass a law that said you must be 100% funded within 7 years, for example, we would put some companies out of business and we put some workers out of business, and some legislators would prefer not to do that, and that's continued to allow exceptions for the companies that tend to get the greatest difficulty.
Mm. Well,
it's a balancing act.
Then I'm sure some people would also say, well, if we're going to allow these companies not to get by without fully funding their plans, and if we're going to rely on the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation to pick up the slack if the company goes under, and if the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is underfunded, then what we should do is we should increase the premiums that the corporations are paying into the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, because at least we ought to make sure that it's fully funded.
That's a good idea. We should have done it initially because it would have avoided creating this particular problem. But as you raise the premiums, again, many companies are fully funded and they have to pay the premium as well. Originally, the payment was a dollar employee. Now it's, even for a fully funded plan, in the $10 range, and it goes up to $90 for companies that are underfunded per employee. Mm-hmm. Well, as you raise that, then companies have an added incentive to drop the plan because they see that the cost of a fully insurance that they don't really need themselves is increasing. So therefore, they would terminate the plan, and you'd have a greater rush to defined contribution plans. So at this point, the trend is to defined contribution plans, and this is very important for individual workers because you're responsible for making investment choices, for planning for your retirement, and then when you do retire, to dealing with a significant sum of money, deciding how you're going to invest it and how you're going to withdraw from that. All of those decisions are taken away from you in a defined benefit plan. You don't have that money to take, and the company invests it and then pays you as long as you live, which is as long as you would generally need the funds. So it makes it much more difficult for individuals, but that can be an advantage because many people will make good decisions and that will benefit from them. Unfortunately, many people make poor decisions and they'll suffer from that.
So you're saying that and people might not like the idea, but that we are in a transitional kind of period where you think that we're going from And even now, I guess a majority of workers aren't covered by defined benefit plans. But the fact of the matter is we're defined benefit plans are going away.
Yes.
We're going from that to defined contribution, and that trend is going along, and over time it's going to continue. And eventually, sometime in the future, there won't be do you think it would be correct to say there won't be any defined benefit pensions anymore?
In the private sector, there probably will be some, but in the public sector, there'll probably still be very many because the decisions are made differently in the public sector than they are in the private sector.
Is the underfunding issue as critical in the public sector as it is in the private sector?
It's more critical in the public sector than the private sector. For one, there's no insurance plan guaranteeing the benefits will be paid if a municipality went into default. So that's entirely at risk for the workers. Secondly, there's no guidelines as to what appropriate funding is, as there is for private plans under ERISA. So states, local governments can almost select whatever funding standards they want to have for themselves and completely underfund the plan, so the workers are at risk on that area. They continue to offer defined benefit plans in part because long-time workers like that. Long-time workers are often very vocal in requesting particular types of benefits in the public sector, and you can pass off the cost for future generations. So a legislator or a local county board member or whatever can make employees happy and put the costs off to the next generation of politicians, which is a great situation to be in. So that's led us to tremendous underfunding in the public sector.
Well, is it the case in those industries? Here I'm going back again to the private sector. In those industries where they have had stable worker populations, large groups of people who are going to work for the corporation for a long time, and that they have offered defined benefit plans, that in part those plans have been offered, in a sense, in lieu of wages. That is, they have said to workers, here, this is a benefit that we can give you, and that instead of paying them more, they're saying, well, you know, we can give you a little bit of an increase here, and it may not be what you really want, but we got a terrific retirement plan for you so that if you work here for 30 years, then you can retire and collect a good benefit, and then you enjoy your retirement and go and cash your check. That somehow it was a way of getting around actually paying more wages by giving a future promise to pay.
Yes, that's exactly what we're doing. And sometimes you fund that currently, but there's also incentives to put that off to a future quarterly reporting period, when perhaps some other executive will be making decisions on that.
Yeah. And as far as the public sector goes, we're relying on the idea or the belief, we're resting on the beliefs that the government has promised to pay and the government will pay. It is just going to be a matter of where they're going to find the money. We're somehow expecting they're going to find it somewhere, and that when it comes time to pay the benefits, they're going to come up with the money and they're going to pay the benefits. Is that a dangerous assumption to make?
It certainly is, because you're taxing future taxpayers in the state for paying benefits that have already been received by the current taxpayers in the state. And if it gets too onerous, you're going to simply encourage people to leave the state, and you'll discourage businesses from opening up in the state. And it would be almost like the pension benefit guarantee corporations. As you try to get adequate funding, you drive more and more potential taxpayers away from the system, so that you have a tremendous problem. So it could be creating economic areas that simply are not developing very effectively simply because of the overhang of unfunded liabilities that have been passed to future generations. Mm-hmm. But most people are assuming that the benefits will be paid. It'll just be paid by higher taxes at some time in the future.
Yeah. I think that some people, when we have these kind of conversations, it's the scenario, the future potential here for disaster seems to be enormous, and that the claims on the government for a variety of things, the claims that might be made on the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation for pensions if corporations go belly up, in addition to everything else, all of the other promises to pay, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, you name it, that it looks like we could be heading for a meltdown, an economic meltdown like we've never seen in this country. I mean, is that going too far to say something like that?
If we delay dealing with the problems for too long, it will develop to that, because if you have to wait until you run out of money in the Social Security system before you start correcting the system, if you wait until the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation can't make payments before you deal with that, that's a major taxpayer bailout. If you wait until public pension funds simply don't have the cash to pay before you start facing the problem, it will be an extreme economic disaster at that point. However, if we started dealing with the problem now, and that's why I'm so delighted to come on a show like this to let people know, this is an important issue and you should pay attention to what politicians do and what business leaders do as far as dealing with future promises for pension benefits, because they'll either be taxes or default at some time in the future. And the people that are proposing useful solutions to that may be the people you want to listen to. You may want to ask people to deal with the problem now rather than wait until it gets to be more difficult, because the sooner we deal with it, the more manageable it will be. If we wait until a long time in the future and then try to deal with it, many people will get hurt. There will be reduced benefits, there will be much higher taxes, and it will be difficult economic situations in the states that have allowed this to occur. And unfortunately, Illinois is one of the states that's been a laggard in funding their pension plans.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Stephen Darcy. He is a professor of finance in the College of Business here at University of Illinois. And we're talking about pensions and the future of pensions. And questions are welcome. We have someone here ready to go. Others can certainly call in, be a part of the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We'll start out with someone in Savoy in line one.
Hello. Yeah, hi, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I worked for a company back in the 80s that had still has a defined benefit plan, and I'm glad I stuck with it. Now, what happened, though, back in about 1987 was, it's my understanding that the U.S. government came to realize there a lot of these plans were actually overfunded in the late 70s and early 80s. And the U.S. government came, and they were overfunded to the point where the U.S. government thought, well, gee, there's a lot of money tied up there. We'd really like to get it out and get some taxes on it. And so they went and they offered what was called a reversion plan, where these plans that were overfunded, they could be, these monies could be diverted to other uses and they just went ahead and they paid a tax on it. Can you comment on that?
That was an interesting situation that developed in the 1980s. When ERISA was first put in, companies were encouraged to fully fund their plan because of the tax benefits that were associated with that, and many companies did. And then the stock market started taking off in the early 1980s, and a number of companies found they had tremendously overfunded pension plans, but the government did not allow them, the rules of the time did not allow them to take excess funds out without terminating the plan. Most companies didn't want to terminate their plan because they were long-time promises. Along came some corporate raiders and found you could buy a company, you could terminate its pension plan, you could then get the assets that were in excess because you would fully fund all promises to the beneficiaries who earned them to date, but there was excess money available. You could then take that money out, and in some cases that money was enough to pay what you paid to buy the company. So we had a tremendous incentive of companies that had money in these plans that now became targets for takeovers that were going to be taken over and the money pulled out of there under a hostile takeover. So Congress responded to that particular problem by saying, we'll allow companies to take money out if it's in excess because we don't want to allow you to make you targets and have the only way you can get it out is by have you terminating the plan. So that was the way they tried to solve that particular problem. And that, again, it tended to work for a while until 2000, when the stock market started underperforming again. And then companies at that point became less fully funded than they were before, and you had some more funding issues associated with that.
Yeah, my impression of that policy back then was essentially, the government, people were just wanting to sweep the granaries clean, and it was one of the worst policies I've ever seen come out of Congress, to allow that.
There probably would have been a much better way of balancing the commitment to current employees and allowing companies that are overfunded to do something so their assets weren't at risk for a takeover.
Yeah.
And the decision that was made, might have been politically practical at the time, but it certainly didn't have the best long-term effects.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, these corporations, the company that I stuck with, they that defined benefit plan, I believe it's going to be there, and they've done a good job. But I'll tell you what, Congress is our real enemy in this department, and I think what went on back then is a good example of it.
Well, you elect congressmen or congresswomen.
Well, they don't do what you say. That's the problem.
If you pay attention and find people that are of your state of mind as far as how pensions should be dealt with, and you let people know that that's important to you, and you and your colleagues and friends and other people, then politicians will pay more attention to that because they do work for us. It's just if we ignore it, if we're willing to say it's a problem that will let be dealt with in 10 or 20 or 30 years, then they've got the incentive to deal with today's crises and not that one. So it's up to us to make this an important issue for people we elect.
I'll tell you what, it is real important, and I agree with you. It's going to be whenever the rent comes due here, it's going to be several orders of magnitude bigger than the savings and loan debacle. Hey, I'll see you later. Your comments are very, very, I think people should listen.
Well, thank you
for the call. Yeah. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, we did, in about the first 20, 25 minutes, we sketched out the problem. What would you suggest, or what are some of the ideas that people would suggest for dealing with this? What should we do?
We should start dealing with the problem soon. We should support politicians who are willing to face this problem now on an ongoing building up basis, and we should resist quick fixes on this. Mm-hmm. In 1995, Illinois passed a pension legislation that guaranteed a ramping up of pension funding so that within 50 years of that, they would be funded at a very adequate level, the 90% level, which is in line with most other plans tend to be in the public sector. But then when we have financial difficulties over the last few years, our elected officials have determined they've changed their position so that they haven't funded the plan at that particular level, putting it off to future years. And if that does solve short-term problems, but it creates problems at some time in the future. If the public is willing to deal with that way of dealing with the problem, we'll face it later. If we're willing to deal with the problem now and not allow that to occur, then things would be different.
Well, as far as shifting over to the private sector, could you take the same kind of approach, and that is, say, to those companies that are not fully funding their pensions, we're going to expect you to do that. We're going to give you a reasonable period of time to do that, but we're not going to let you drag your heels. And by the same token, I guess we would say, well, if the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is not adequately funded, we need to do something about that, too. We may not be able to do that this, bring it up to where it should be this year, but again, do the same sort of thing. Now, you were talking earlier about the fact that if we increase the premiums dramatically, then there are some companies that'll just say, well, we can't even afford this. We're just going to get out of the pension business. So, if you don't want that to happen, is there some way with both of those where you can, in a gradual sense, try and get more corporations to fully fund their pensions and get the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation funded at the level where it should be?
Yes, there is legislation in Washington now to do just that. Unfortunately, it does give loopholes and exemptions for some industries that are viewed as being in difficult financial times, and that would exacerbate the problem for them. But dealing with this now and dealing on a gradual basis could solve the problem in the long term, but postponing it is really going to create the problem.
Well, you mentioned the fact, and it is true, that there in some cases there have been corporations, if they're going through difficult times, if they're in Chapter 11, we're going to say to you, yeah, we realize that maybe you can't fully fund your pension if you're trying to keep the company going and keep from going under. So maybe it makes sense for some period of time to say, okay, we'll give you a pass right this year or for the next couple of years. Is there anything really wrong with that, or is there, in fact, really any way to get around that? If the company is in that, if the conditions are that bad, don't we actually have to be able to say to them, okay, as a measure of you're trying to get yourself back together, we're going to say, okay, it's fine, you can cut back on your paying into your pension, but we're expecting when things get better, you're going to get back to it, and we hope that at one point you're going to get back to the point where your company's healthy, you're doing well, and you're going to get back to fully funding your pension.
That's a great way to do it for a temporary problem. But if you do it for a company that has no chance of catching up and having better times, then you're just prolonging the situation and making it worse. For example, the savings and loans in the 70s, they had no possibility of recovering, and we simply allowed some of the companies to continue operating far too long. There are certain industries that, because of their high labor costs, because of their lack of competition, are gradually going out of business. And if we give them a temporary pass, then it's just going to get worse. But if we had an industry that were only suffering a temporary problem because of a hurricane in New Orleans, for example, but they're going to get back on their feet. That makes more sense to do that. Unfortunately, it's difficult politically to separate that and say your industry is failing. There's no way that we're going to give you a bailout because you're not going to recover, especially if that's in your district and those voters are the people who put you into office. So there will be pressure from certain individuals to let's cover the industries in my locale because they're going to get back on their feet at some time. Realistically, they aren't. So that's a difficult thing to do, but we can do it. I mean, it's you could use expertise to determine which industries are in the long-term downward trend and which industries are simply having a short-term cycle and only give the exceptions to the ones that are in temporary problems, not the long-term ones.
Okay. Let's talk with someone. We have several other callers. Someone next in Urbana, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Two things. One is I think that it was easier for the governor and state legislature to borrow against the state pension funds because I think most people probably don't realize that, for instance, the university pension funds are not, people are not covered by Social Security. The state is exempt from Social Security in doing their this particular pension fund. I'm not sure if this is true of all the state pension funds. So it's not as though university employees have Social Security to fall back on. And then the second thing is that we punish legislators and elected officials if they vote to raise taxes. And Republicans call Democrats spend and, what is it again?
Tax and spend.
Tax and spend.
Liberals, yeah.
And, yeah, tax and spend liberals, whereas I think we need to hold the people's feet to the fire and start coming up with some other terms like spend and borrow, spend and drive into debt slavery, or something. I don't know. But we need to stop allowing this as voters to be used against legislators because we have to pay our bills. We're not paying for the Iraq War. I mean, we talk about supporting our troops and we're going into debt and hoping that the poor soldiers, when they come back, will help pay for it. I don't know. It seems to be even a larger problem beyond the pension stuff. I'm finding this very informative. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to comment about the don't have Social Security to fall back on. Unfortunately, when we start talking about pensions, many people get concerned that their pension won't be paid. And I want to make sure that people who are collecting public pensions, whether the state teachers or the state university's funds or any of the other state funds, even though there's an unfunded liability, there's plenty of funds available to pay all of the commitments that are made today. So you don't have to worry about not receiving it. In fact, the state constitution guarantees that those payments will be made. If the state were to get low on funds at some time in the future, they still will have to follow through with that commitment. However, so don't be concerned about if you're living on a fixed income and getting this benefit of being cut because there are plenty of funds. The funds have $50-60 billion that are available to support the commitments. Unfortunately, they have larger than that obligations, but those obligations are due at some time in the future. They will be paid, but it's going to be increasing the financial resources, increasing taxes at some time in the future. And the caller is directly right that if we punish people who raise taxes to pay our bills, then we're just encouraging people to go further into debt. If we have an obligation, if we pay our police officers, if we pay our teachers, if we pay our professors and give them a pension benefit, then we have to be willing to pay the taxes associated with receiving those particular services. And we shouldn't be pushing, be unwilling to have anyone make those payments as long as we're making the commitments on the first.
What is the thinking behind the exemption from or the exclusion of state workers from federal Social Security?
If you're covered under Social Security, you have to pay the 7.65% of income of salary that goes into the Social Security system. So the state would have to make that payment to the federal government, and that's a cash drain on the state. So when the last Social Security reform was passed in the 1980s, there was an exemption for any state or state government that had exempted its workers from Social Security and had continued to do so in the future. They can join Social Security at any time, but if they were out of it, they were not swept in at that particular time. I think Dan Rostenkowski was probably very influential in getting that through the House Ways and Means because he was chair at the time, and he realized that Illinois didn't want to have to start paying the Social Security taxes because that was going to be a cash drain. it's much easier to have a state pension fund that they can not pay in years that they don't want to. And that's why we don't have the Social Security system for some workers, especially for people who are working for the state of Illinois.
Yeah, so it was simply a matter of saving the state money.
It saves the state money in the short term. In the long term, they would have to cover the pension funds themselves.
Okay. All right. To another caller, and this would be someone calling from Southern Illinois, someone who's on a cell phone, so we'll get right there, line four. Hello.
Curiosity. On the funding, you know, like for retirement programs that, you know, these corporate raiders take, I have an old friend that worked in a coal mine, and we'll say he was going to receive, we'll say, $100 a month. But after the coal mine was sold to someone else, shall we say to a raider, excuse me, they reduced his payment, we'll say, like $25 down to $75. What, why do they include this, shall we say, surplus funding in his retirement pay originally, but comes back down to reality of $75.
I'm not sure of the exact situation that you're describing, but I think that if the coal worker were expecting to get a pension that was at a particular level, such as $75, but to date, you know, they were only 45 years old, and to date they'd only earned a benefit of $25, then the corporation could be sold. The new owners could say, we're terminating the pension plan, but you already have what you've earned, and you've earned $25. Now, if we had kept the plan and you worked another 10 years, you would have gotten $75, but all you get is $25, and we have terminated the plan, and at that point, we can take any excess assets out of the plan.
Yeah. Well, he had retired at full retirement, you know, age or whatever, but they reduced his retirement benefits after the coal mine was bought out. That's why I was curious. Hmm.
There might have been some payment that came from, an additional fund that they had that was available, was drawing on surplus funds, and then when that was taken away, it did. But again, I'm not aware of those facts in detail.
Okay. Well, I think it's kind of a crime that, you know, they put it in, whatever. Another thing that really bothers me, I'm self-employed and whatever, and I pay my own insurance, and I pay my own savings and whatever for retirement. And there's no, shall we say, funding per se from anyone else. And I have a 401k and I guess some Social Security. But, you know, I don't really condemn anybody for having it, but why should everybody get a, shall we say, a pension? Why doesn't people just save for their own? You know, like school teachers and corporate people and whatever.
Well, more and more people are going to be in your situation as we shift to defined contribution plans from defined benefit plans.
Yeah.
You ask why state workers would have a pension plan, a defined benefit pension plan. It's because they have bargained for it. The employer feels that in lieu of giving higher wages, they will give them some sort of a pension or health insurance or other deferred benefits, and then that will be part of the total compensation package.
They're paying for it at the end, so they just will give them a payment, and shall we say, if they live beyond their means, it's so sorry, too bad, you know.
Well, it makes sense to have a defined benefit plan because the workers basically are sharing longevity risk. The person who lives to 95 will be getting a benefit as long as they live, whereas the worker, the retiree who dies earlier, gets a shorter benefit. So basically, individuals don't have to worry about living too long because the whole pool is sharing that particular risk. That's not an advantage that you have when you have a plan, 401k, and if you take the money out of that. However, you could go to an insurance company and purchase an annuity in which then that insurance company would share the risk of your longevity with other people they sell annuities to and be able to pay you for as long as you would live.
What do you think of annuities for retirement?
It surprises economists that more people don't take annuities because it does prevent you from outliving your assets. But when people are faced with having a significant sum at retirement and drawing down that on their own versus turning it over to an insurance company and letting the insurance company pay as long as they live, most people tend to make the decision that they'll leave it as a fund and they'll draw down from it. But they're risking two things, not taking out enough money and having too much left or not having anything left and living longer than that. So as part of your retirement plan, you probably want to have an annuity to prevent that longevity risk from hurting you, but you probably want to keep other funds that you invest on your own and have access to.
Yeah. Or a bad thing about annuities is some of these insurance companies don't whatever do fold. And you're left in the cold.
And they're, yeah, they do that, but there's also some guarantee funds on a state basis that protect individuals on some annuities payments as well. So you should talk to a financial planner when you're getting close to making these decisions, because they're very complicated decisions.
Yeah.
And once you make certain decisions, you can't undo them. So that's why getting professional advice before you make a decision is very useful to do.
Well, very good program.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I just you touch on something that I think is a concern that people raise about this trend, the move away from defined benefit to defined contribution, where essentially what people are doing is that they're supposed to be saving for their own retirement, and that there may be some kind of a plan that they pay into. The corporation may do some kind of match. The concern is that. And it reflects the burden on existing pension funds that people are living longer than they used to. The concern is that if you have a 401k, that you're going to outlive your money. Do you think that is likely to be a concern if this trend continues and we have more and more people who have their own retirement plans that they are funding? Are we going to find ourselves in a place where we're going to have people suddenly being broke because the money that they have managed to save is gone and they're still alive?
It depends on what you used, how much you take out of the fund at a particular time. If you want to be very safe and not have very much of a chance at all at outliving your assets, unfortunately, you can only take a very small percentage, 1-3% of your assets each year, and spend that, and the rest is expected to be invested and continue to grow. So you will never outlive that. But again, you're underspending your assets because most people won't live until 100 or 110, so they could have spent a greater percentage of it. So one danger is that you would underspend your assets because you're so concerned about longevity risk that you save it all, and that's not what it's intended for. And the other concern is that you draw down the assets at what you think is a reasonable rate or what you need to pay, which might be even higher than that, and then it turns out that you do run out of assets on doing that. So it's a concern that people will be facing, and it's a balancing act. And you get financial advice. You need to spend some time reading financial journals and brushing up on that, or finding a very good advisor you trust and having them help you on this particular area.
Okay. Our guest in this part of Focus, Stephen Darcy. He's professor of finance in the College of Business at University of Illinois. And we're talking about pensions and the future of pensions. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's caller in Champaign and line 3.
Hello. Yes. I'm curious what you thought of the arguments made by our representatives to the state government in the press about CSRS, and specifically Representative Jacobson arguing that her vote to, in a sense, raid the plan was in fact a good thing for CSRS, and in particular her argument that people should not necessarily depend on this state constitutional guarantee because the Constitution is in fact easily amended and the Republicans might do this.
Okay. The second argument first, that the Constitution can be amended, is true, and it does require a supermajority, but if the situation becomes so dire at some time in the future, then the benefits could be changed. Now, what you normally have is a company can change benefits that have not been earned, but will be earned at some time in the future. So if a company has a pension plan and workers have worked a certain number of years and earned a particular pension benefit to date, that can't be taken away. However, they can stop providing that benefit in the future. In the state of Illinois, though, there's an impairment clause that prevents the government from changing benefits from current workers. So if the government wanted to make a change in the pension benefit, for example, drop the accrual rate, for example, or not, that's the rate at which you get a percent of your salary when you retire based on the number of years you've worked, or if they wanted to take away one of the options on the retirement plan for the state, which in the state university system there is both a defined benefit and defined contribution plan, and you get paid the higher of the two. If they want to do that, they can only change it for workers hired tomorrow or later. They can't change it for somebody who's 25 years old, 30 years old, working for the state. So any pension benefit that's in effect when you start working has to be continued all during your working career. So that puts the state of Illinois in a much more difficult financial position than corporations who can change benefits for the future for their current employees. Now, what I think Representative Jacobson was saying is that a law could be changed that would reduce the benefits for current workers that they would earn at some time in the future, not the ones they've already earned, but earned at some time in the future by having this majority. It would not be able to take away benefits from people who are already retired. Courts tend to protect that. Once somebody has retired from a system, they are not in a situation where they're contracting and deciding what to do. Whereas a worker could, if they didn't like the new pension benefits, stop working for the company or stop working for the state and go work somewhere else. So courts would allow that, but again, it would require a constitutional change. So that would be a possibility, and that may happen if the state continues to defer pension payments, but that's well down the road. The argument that this is actually helping CSRS, I don't believe the people at CSRS would consider it helping when they're not getting the benefits that they, the income they promised to get or were expecting to get under prior legislation, and therefore in a more less tenable financial position than before. So as a beneficiary under CSRS, I don't buy the argument that CSRS is better off by funding being taken away this year.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Just to make sure I understand, if you have a corporation, it has a defined benefit plan, and it says to me today, when you retire, we're going to pay you we're going to give you $100 a month. There's nothing to prevent them from next year. Say, and I am a current worker. I'm working along, and they're saying to Dave, the day you retire, we're going to start paying you $100 a month. There's nothing to stop them from, say, next year, them coming back to me and saying, well, Dave, actually, I know we told you we were going to give you $100 a month, but in fact, we're really only going to give you $75. They can do that?
Okay. Is that a pension benefit?
Yes.
No, they couldn't do that. If the current year you have earned a $100 pension benefit when you retire, then they have to come through with a commitment of that. However, if they're saying that every year you work for us, we'll give you $100 or $20 a month in retirement, and you have worked for there for a while, and then they say, well, we're going to change that. It's not going to be $50 a month. It's going to be $20 a month or $20. It's going to go down to $10 for future years that you work. That is acceptable for corporations. It's not acceptable for the state of Illinois workers to get that because of the non-impairment provisions.
Okay, so what the corporation can do is that they can, at some point, they can change the way that they calculate your benefit from that point forward, but they can't. It cannot be retroactive. Is that
they can't take away benefits that you've earned under the current system. They can change the way the formula is recalculated, but it can't take away a benefit that you've already earned for the service that you've done for the company.
All right. And the promise to pay, I guess the other thing that I'm interested in is what is the nature of the promise to pay, and does that – it sounds as if the promise to pay doesn't survive the corporation. If there's a promise to pay, if the corporation promises to pay benefits to the workers, if the corporation goes out of business or if somebody comes along and buys it, does that mean the promise to pay is – ends at that point?
Well, the company has funds that have been set aside to fund pension liabilities, and those would be the pension assets, and they also have obligations would be the pension liabilities. If a company were to go out of business, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation would take all the assets that are earmarked for pension funds, and they would assume the liabilities. If they're in balance, there's no problem, but the liabilities tend to be higher than the assets, and then the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, up to certain limits, so the limit is in the $45,000 a year in pension benefits, are guaranteed by the PBGC, and then they get their revenue from taxing other companies to fund the shortfall.
Yeah.
If another company took the plan over, they wouldn't have access to the pension assets. If they terminated the plan, those pension assets would still be devoted for. But when you terminate a plan, nobody is earning additional benefits in the future, so suddenly the cost of the plan goes down and your liabilities would drop in that particular situation. So when you're looking at funding levels, you need to be concerned about whether it's a current funding, are you funding on the basis of an ongoing corporation, or you're funding as if you were to terminate at the end of the year. And if you were assuming you're going to terminate at the end of the year, the expenses are going to be much higher because of the fact that benefits that you promised to people have to be met at that point rather than deferred.
Mm-hmm. We'll try to get one more call here. Savoy, line one.
I just turned the radio on, and I'm hoping that I'm not repeating a question or an issue. But
sure. Go ahead.
In my mind, it seems that our accounting standards for instance, companies that are publicly traded are, you know, on the magnitude of third world emerging markets sometimes when it comes to the treatment of underfunded corporate pensions in the way that's reflected on the balance sheets and thus the share price of stocks. And one of my doomsday scenarios that I think is viable is that corporations start declaring bankruptcy in order to escape those under those pension liabilities, such as you've seen in the airlines, and I think you'll see in the big three automakers and a lot of corporate America. And, you know, when that happens, equity is wiped out, and to me that's a somewhat viable doomsday scenario on the stock market. And like you just, you know, tell me why that's not a realistic, viable scenario. Convince me, if you could, that it's not a risk.
Well, some companies will do that. Companies that are in financial difficulty, that have an aging workforce, are not growing rapidly enough to be able to bring in new workers to cover the cost of the system for them and spread the costs over younger workers. They could have difficulty. As a whole, most companies would not be in that position, because if you do terminate your pension plans, then a portion of your assets, beyond whether pension assets, but a portion of the assets the company has are can be seized by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation to pay those benefits. So for most viable companies, you wouldn't want to terminate and default to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, because the cost would be too high in your own assets. But we do have certain industries, steel workers, perhaps auto, the legacy airlines, that are facing that difficulty, and hopefully it'll be limited rather than a major disaster.
So you don't see the problem being as widespread as I might think it is?
It will probably be limited to the industries you mentioned and a few others, not the entire universe of investing companies.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, we are at the point where we're going to have to finish with the promise that this is a subject we'll try to continue to watch, and I'm sure that we will talk about again. But for the moment, we will leave it there with our thanks to our guest, Stephen Darcy. He's the John Brogan Faculty Scholar in Risk Management and Insurance and Professor of Finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Focus 580, this program made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated, serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. And that's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Coming up is the Afternoon Magazine. Back today as host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll dip into the archives and we'll rebroadcast an interview.